Okay, thank
Christensen?
you. Yes.
Bagai?
Yes.
Blazik? Brady?
I'm here.
Brownstein?
I'm here.
Jermaine?
Present.
Lout?
You might be muted, Dr. Lout.
Apologies. Present.
Snell?
Here.
And Hero and Beanstalk are absent.
Awesome. Well, is there, thank you for all being here. We hope we can be this nice and effective and concentrated meeting and hopefully get going here in the next few minutes and then maybe be done here in the next hour and a half or so. Do we have any discussion or possible action items from the previous committee meeting that we held on March 1st? It's been a little while. So any discussion from that or anybody want to approve the minutes from the March 1st meeting?
I move to approve.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Looks like it's unanimous there, Sherry. I'll read this here on this NPR, this notice of proposed rulemaking, the committee to be reviewed and discussed and take possible actions to recommend that a board approve the draft NPR for submission to Governor's Regulatory Review Council, including proposed changes to Title IV, Chapter 11, Articles 1, 3, 4, 12, and 13, which include amendments to the board's anesthesia and sedation rules. Does anybody have any comments before we get started? I know that we've kind of been plugging along at a pretty good pace, I felt, and I think things have been really beneficial to read some of these things. I know that there's a lot of minutia involved, but I've been really impressed with how things are really kind of coming together. Appreciate everybody's great work and just the fact that you're here and willing to put forth some time. We appreciate that. Do we have any comments? Concerns? If not, we'll go ahead and move on. We have Jessica on the line, right, who's been kind of guiding us through that. Is that correct, Jesse? Jessica, are you here?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for coming.
Of course. So if you would like to get started, I can go ahead and share my screen and we can just dive right into the language where we left off back in March.
Yes. Let's do that. Does anybody have anything else to add? Or are you okay with that? Jumping into where we were at before. You know what page that was on, Jessica?
Yes, it is right at the top of page 13. And it is the final section of Rule 1301.
I do have one comment as I've read through most of this. Again, is this that we had, it's still stating that it's 8 and younger, and it's actually, I think everybody's agreed that it's been the age is 7 and under. Is that correct? That's where we've been at. But I know throughout the documents here, it continues to say 8 and under. So that's just one thing that caught my attention as I was rereading some of these corrections.
So if you're talking about the very last subsection B here, that is correct. It needs to be changed. We haven't quite gotten there yet.
Awesome.
You know, I did have just one question. This is Ali Pagai. It looks like just towards the end of the last meeting, which I unfortunately wasn't able to make due to clinical obligations, you know, we erased the definition of what, you know, and sorry, I'll reference it. It's section, it's 1301O, and where it references, there you go. So work with a non-dental anesthesia or sedation provider. And then I was trying to see where that is. Did that get defined somewhere else? I didn't see it in the definitions to define what a non-dental anesthesia or sedation provider is.
I believe it did.
Actually, I don't think it has yet, except up here at the very top. Non-dental anesthesia or sedation provider means a physician, anesthesiologist, right, or a certified registered nurse anesthetist.
Okay, I was looking alphabetically. Thanks for clarifying that.
Ali, we had debated that over and over, and I think we decided that the definition needed to be very clear as to who that was. So, you know, we didn't have EMTs providing sedation or you know, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Sorry for occupying time for a meeting I missed. I appreciate you guys taking that time to review that.
You bet, Ali. Okay.
So that leaves us here at the new subsection Q for Rule 1301 relating to general anesthesia and sedation. So a Section 1301 permit holder who has obtained a pediatric endorsement according to subsection B and who administers general anesthesia, deep sedation, or any lower level of sedation to a pediatric patient shall ensure two of the following additional persons are present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure: a person having a current certification in basic life support healthcare provider level endorsed by the American Heart Association, and a person who has a current certification in PALS or ACLS, or who has accreditation from a board-approved assistant course. Then it goes on further to say that if the operating dentist is the Section 1301 permit holder, in other words, oral and maxillofacial surgeon, there must be a qualified auxiliary staff whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient during the procedure. The auxiliary must have current certification in a board-approved training program for such a role and have current certification in PALS.
Jason, you had a comment? Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah, I do. I'm assuming that the IE, the example oral maxillofacial surgeon, will actually stay in there. Am I correct in that assumption? That's just for us as a note to us. And the reason I ask that is because there are, even though there's very few, and I don't know of really any in Arizona that practice this way, but there are dentist anesthesiologists that practice the same way. You know, they're doing the anesthesia and the dentistry, just like this is describing.
So this is Jessica. I would actually recommend removing the parentheticals. You don't typically include parentheticals in your rule language.
Yeah, that's what my recommendation is too.
I also think we need to have, or at least I thought we had agreed that the one providing the sedation for, or at least responsible for the sedation for a pediatric patient needed to have PALS certification. It wasn't an or PALS or ACLS. It was a PALS specific.
Sure. I think you're right, John. Dr. Blazek checked in at 1240 or 240.
Yeah, I've been here the whole time, Eddie.
Oh, you have? Good.
I just threw my camera on. I just realized. And okay. I was going to echo what John said. Yeah, John, you're right. We said that if you're doing the sedation for the pediatric patient, not only do you need the pediatric designation, but you must have the PALS certification. I think you're right, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it shouldn't be or it should, that should be PALS.
So remove everything after or? They have to have a current certification in PALS or ACLS?
If we're talking about a pediatric office, it probably doesn't even need to be ACLS, right? It could just be in PALS.
Yeah, I would just have PALS. I'm just trying to decide, do we need to specify that that individual is the one providing the sedation? Are we going to get into a scenario where the one who has PALS is the nurse or the tech or the dentist, neither of which who may not be providing the sedation, and another dentist or anesthesiologist, CRNA or dental anesthesiologist do not have PALS but have ACLS that are providing the sedation? Do we need to clarify that, do you think?
I think we do. That's why I have my hand raised. But
yeah.
Perfect.
Because then you look at Q1, isn't it to the following additional persons, suggesting that it's additional to the provider?
Correct.
Oh, Snell, you're right on, man.
So if I'm reading this right, what it's saying is that the 1301 permit holder could have two additional people that have PLS, and that's sufficient.
No, I think it says and.
Go ahead, Heath.
I was just saying between A and B have that and, which should suggest, does that mean that they, you can have two that have BLS, or you have to have a BLS and one that has PALS?
So from a rule writing, from a rule writing standpoint, I would say that you're correct. That is ambiguous. Whether number one is saying that the two following individuals have to have both A and B, or if you can have two individuals, one who falls under A and one who falls under B.
You can't really you can't really have one that falls under B and doesn't have basic life support. Like basic life support is a prerequisite. Is it to have PALS?
So do we want to allow two additional individuals that could both only have BLS?
And yeah, to further question what he said is, could it be one with PALS and one with BLS, and that's sufficient?
Go ahead, Jason.
So when we were meeting in the committee for this, I think the intent was behind this was that the 1301 permit holder has PALS in and of itself, and then they have to assure that there is at least two assistants, one with at least BLS and the other one with at least PALS.
Correct.
Well, I thought we also made that clarification. They could have ACLS if it was an assistant or a board approved assistant course. I think we did talk about
I think that the reason behind that, Dr. Christensen, at least what Jason was just saying, was that in a crisis situation, because PALS is much different in a code situation in a large code than ACLS. It's run differently. And so if you've got especially now that we're doing 7 and younger, a child in a code situation, to have two people who are PALS trained, in theory, should be able to run that code better than having one PALS and one ACLS, both of which are trained in different, operations from a code perspective. That was at least the conversation around that decision.
Correct.
So the idea is that in the pediatric patients, there'll be at least, so the bare minimum would be three people. One person is a 1301 permit holder who also would have PALS, right? One person is somebody who gets PALS, which could be a variety of professionals. And one person who has BLS. That's what we're saying would be the bare minimum.
Yeah, that should be that the bare minimum of all in any 13, in any general anesthetic case. Go ahead, Randy.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So basically the way the rules are written now is you must have three individuals besides the permit holder present. You should have someone monitoring the anesthesia, someone performing the assistant, and then a third individual who is usually chairside in some offices or is readily available to be there. So that's kind of the way that it's written now. The reason I raised my hand initially was because we've gone through this twice now at the meeting before last, where we talked about the need for a surgical assistant to have PAL certification as well as the 1301 permit holder who has a pediatric designation. And I believe that the committee was, I would say, you know, much smaller. We didn't have everybody present. But during that discussion, we had talked about with Dr. Lout about removing the requirement for the assistant to have PALS. And I tell you, the reason I think we did that, John, was I think putting the onus on an assistant to realistically pass a PALS course is probably not even realistic.
Yeah, thanks, Randy. That was the discussion. I think that's why we landed back on having the and or, the or and or with ACLS and the board certified like a dance certification was what was discussed.
Further the point, so let's say I don't have a pediatric designation. I'm a 1301 permit holder, and I decided to hire Jason to come in and do my anesthesia. Well, now if we push that forward, then that means another individual, either myself or one of my assistants, would have to have a pediatric designation, not just the permit holder, but I'd have to go get PALS. So that's where I think the idea of having to have two individuals present that have PALS certification during an anesthetic for someone 7 years and under, it kind of falls apart there when we have to have two providers there with PALS certification.
I think if I'm trying to figure out what the exact intent of the language would be, is in that situation that you mentioned, Dr. Blazek, you bring Jason in, he would be the 1301P, and then that would mean if you had PALS, you would qualify as the person that's 1B, and then one of your staff members or someone that Dr. Brady brought with him would have to have BLS. Right, and then you'd get it as we're trying to write it, but
as it's written, but, correct.
I'm asking questions because I don't know if that's what the intent is.
But he's saying if he doesn't have PALS, nor do his assistants, then if we were to push for this, then Jason's assistant, whoever he brings, would have to have PALS as well.
Right.
I tend to agree with Dr. Blazek. I just thinking from a practical standpoint of if we give this P designation, there's going to be several providers who may or may not do, but will have the ability to do sedation on a child and bring a dental anesthesiologist in to do that. But if, say, Jason is that dental anesthesiologist, if he doesn't bring someone with a pediatric or with a PALS certification, then that procedure won't be able to be done because I'm not going to carry PALS if I'm and not routinely seeing pediatric patients. But if I have a pediatric patient, I'm in Dr. Blazek's case where I just have that one or two a year and I feel comfortable bringing Jason in to do it, but I have ACLS and my assistants are trained and have ACLS or BLS. I think that should be able to, that procedure should be able to be done.
So from what I hear, you guys are suggesting we leave it as it is. So there's a BLS and then there's an ACLS or PALS.
Or board certified or board approved assistant course.
Yeah, for the two additional providers.
But the pediatric designation always has a PALS certification.
Right.
I think that's fine. And I would suspect that, you know, one who's doing a lot of pediatrics, their staff will probably end up getting PALS certified anyway. But I think you're right, Heath and Randy.
So should the language, if that's what we're saying, should the language say two people having BLS or one having BLS and one having PALS? Are you guys saying that the one permit holder with PALS and then two people with BLS should be sufficient?
What if we said one person, and you could, I know you don't like to do this, Jessica, but how can we indicate that the person carrying the 1301 permit with the P designation is included in this A and B? That person can be considered as one of the two additional. Is that?
No, I think what it's saying here is the 1301 permit holder with the P designation, to have the P designation, they have to have PALS. So that's one individual with PALS. And then in addition to that, which is what number one says, two of the following additional persons need to be present. So we're defining who are those two additional individuals.
That are PALS or ACLS. Okay, then correct. We can leave it as it is. I see. Yeah.
Or as Ali is saying, that they could be just BLS certified. Is that a possibility?
That's what I'm asking for clarity. Yeah. Cause if I'm reading this, what it's telling me is that you're needing the bare minimum is your permit holder who has PALS, one person with BLS and one person with PALS. But it sounds like in the example of somebody who has a 1301, or gosh, it could even be someone who doesn't have any permit at all, brings in Dr. Brady. That means that in that scenario, does there also have to be someone with PALS in addition to Dr. Brady, or just two people with BLS? Because if that's what we're going for, why even have B? Just have it say two people that have BLS.
My vote, and I probably Dr. Blazek or Dr. Brady can speak better to this, but my vote would have at least one of them have either PALS or ACLS, and then one of them, and if they have that, you could have two. If there were, you know, if there's a dental assistant and Dr. Blazek and they both had ACLS, that would suffice. But at least one of them should have PALS or ACLS, and then a second one could have as minimum of as BLS.
That could be a little tricky for some of these offices still, to Dr. Brady's point, and even some of these general practice offices. They're not going to have ACLS. They're not going to have PALS. They're not going to have a dance certified assistant there.
I'd ask Dr. Brady, defer to Dr. Brady to see what his current, I mean, the, all the pediatric offices that you go to that this might focus on.
The problem, though, is that you're not going to have anyone there except for that one person who's PAL certified who has ever run a code or a mock code. Right? There will be no one there who will have been trained to run a code. So if that person who's trying to manage an airway and is, you know, trying to run a code, the people who are just BLS certified who did an online training for an hour or whatever are going to look at him like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. I can see that. Go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, John and Eddie, you both said exactly what I was going to say is, you know, we have this issue occurring with the 1304 permit where, you know, previously to this 1304, the general dentist at least had to do ACLS before he could get his permit to do anesthesia in the office. Well, that's gone. And so in the event that they hire an outside provider, as our current statutes are written, Dr. Brady, I know, brings an assistant. Heath, I know you bring an assistant. Ali, you've talked about sometimes even bringing another CRNA. And I think that is really awesome. But unfortunately, we know not everybody provides their level, their care to that level. And I would like to see us move in that fashion. And this may be the start of the conversation, but maybe there's an opportunity to add a subsection, which is what we've talked about briefly too, where we define what type of an auxiliary person would be acceptable as a second in anesthesia delivery systems. And it would be someone who's had ACLS training, someone who's had dance certification, and they could be the second to the individual who has PALS and that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Dr. Blazek. Dr. Brady?
Yeah, I agree. As it's written, I think it's fine.
That's an excellent circle we just made. I think everybody's good with that, though.
So are we comfortable then with how it's currently written? We have the Section 1301 permit holder who has obtained the pediatric endorsement and who is administering the general anesthesia or any lower level of sedation will ensure that the following additional persons are present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure, those people being one person having a current certification in basic life support endorsed by the American Heart Association, and one person who has a current certification in PALS or ACLS, or who has accreditation from a board-approved assistant course.
Yeah. Yes, that's what it's looking like. Dr. Brady?
So the only thing I would say is if we're spelling out pediatric advanced life support, we probably should spell out ACLS as well. And I would also add in there endorsed by the American Heart Association or who has accreditation from a board-approved assistance course. Because the same with BLS, there's some like fly-by-wire PALS and ACLS things that are out there.
So with regard to acronyms, we're more than welcome to use them. We just have to define them. So it's just a matter of whether
I just want to be consistent. That's all.
Correct.
Either way is fine.
And I have no preference, so it's whatever the board would like to do or what you would like to suggest to the board.
So I would suggest if we're using this multiple times, PALS, ACLS, and it looks like we are, that we just use the acronyms and then define it. And then maybe that definition endorsed by the American Heart Association can be in the actual definition. That way it's very clear what we're talking about when we say BLS, PALS, or ACLS, that we're not having this repeated thing over and over again, that we're talking about the one that's endorsed by the AHA.
I like that line of thought.
So we'll just include all those in the definitions, the PALS, ACLS, even the dance will be part of our definitions. Do we want to switch those around? I know it's a small thing, but do we want to put B in front of A and A below B? I don't know. Seems like B requires requiring more than A is. I don't know. It just seems like it might make more sense to me.
I can do that.
Oh, you're just saying list the higher level of training first.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. And really, because A in that case is only saying basic life support. It's not really saying all the other information because that's covered. Right.
That's correct. Now this should work, Dr. Brady and Dr. Loud, I guess you could speak to this too, and Dr. Brownstein. Now most of this is going to be covered when you go to your pediatric offices, right? I mean, all your pediatric dentists are PALS certified and things. So you already have that built in most of your offices.
Correct. Or we are going to have a resident with us or an assistant that has PALS too. And I mean, it just, you know, even if we're going on to do a one-off situation with like a GP on a special needs child or something of that nature, we need to make sure that system's in place. I doubt that we're going to run into an issue with this the way that most of the dentist anesthesiologists are practicing and who they're practicing with.
Sure, but okay, great. Susie, you had your hand raised?
I'm just wondering where it says a board approved course. We don't regulate dental assistants, and who's going to approve the course? I'm just a little confused by that phraseology, accreditation from a board approved assistant course. We don't regulate assistants.
That's a great point. I think we'll start with Dr. Brady and then Dr. Blazer can go after him. And I think we can run some work
that. Sure. I'm sure we're probably going to say the I think the idea behind this is that we're not labeling a certain educational program that may or may not exist in the future, or, you know, or there may be newer programs that come on board, such as PAIRS and DANCE and Cal Amos, those types of programs where they would definitely, you know, I think as an anesthesia advisory panel, we could possibly even give a list separate to that. But the idea was that we're not having to do a rules and regulation change, or even showing that the board is actually endorsing a type of program, so to speak. So I think that was the idea behind that. But, you know, I'm assuming what you're saying, Susie, is that the board doesn't necessarily give approval or dismissals of certain programs. Is that correct in Arizona? I know in Mississippi we do that. There's a board approved list for certain things that are in the rules and regulations. So maybe this is different with Arizona.
Yeah, we don't do that. And we don't regulate the dental assistants at all. They're not given a certificate by us.
Thank you, Dr. Brady and Susie. Dr. Blazek, you're muted.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, what Dr. Brady said is something we've discussed already, and it's interesting that you should bring it up, Susie, because, you know, as someone who was trained in California and worked there, and, you know, they have really, or I have a lot of assistants that are from California, and they do get their, you know, approval to do certain things like coronal polishing and things like that, or x-ray certification. And I broached this topic briefly with Ryan about, you know, what is it in our state that we do as far as dental assistance? And, you know, I wasn't really sure how we try to provide them any kind of a certification or assure that they have some type of training. We just leave it up to the dentist, I guess. I think this is a little bit different, and I would say what Dr. Brady said is accurate in that we feel there's opportunities out there to see that assistants get further training, and in particular in terms of anesthesia evaluation and monitoring. And these courses that he mentioned, I would have said the same ones. A lot of other states already do that. In fact, there's, I think, 13 other states that provide an opportunity for a surgical assistant to get advanced training in anesthesia monitoring. And those are the types of things I think that do make the model that we're trying to create, which is one in where an anesthesia provider can come into an environment and can provide anesthesia. And in the case of an adverse occurrence, he has someone by his side that has some understanding of nomenclature and running of a office-based emergency that will make a big difference in correcting an adverse occurrence or saving a life. Currently, most oral surgeons' offices do this. In the next 2 years, it's going to be mandatory that the oral surgeon's office has at least two DANCE or equivalent surgical assistants. And I know the people here on this committee that do anesthesia offices, this is the walk they walk or the talk they talk, that the anesthesia assistants that they bring have some advanced training. So maybe it's not in our current statutes, but if there's a way to put it in there that shows that our state is taking public safety first and foremost, and we're doing it by making sure not only the providers train, but the assistants train. That's kind of the goal. And it's a great conversation, Susie. I'm really glad you brought it up, because it is an area that we have talked about, and we're wondering where to go next.
Thank you, Dr. Blazek. Jessica?
Yeah, so I had the same question in my comments when I first read through and put all this language together, because you're absolutely right. I don't believe the board regulates dental assistants, and so putting this language in here like that would require a lot more rules and a lot more work from the board in order to do this, because not only are you then requiring the board to go through and approve assistant courses, but there needs to be rules on how they're approved. You know, what sort of qualifications they have to have in order to get board approval, and how a particular, course provider can petition or ask the board to get their courses approved and that sort of thing. So it's a much bigger endeavor than just putting the language in here.
Can I make a comment? This is Mary Williams.
You bet, Mary.
All right. Hello. So welcome. I just want to point out, thank you. So everybody, yes, all the comments I agree with so far. There is a statute just kind of to build on. 32-1291, there's two things a dental assistant. They may expose radiographs under general supervision if the assistant has passed an exam approved by the board. And then a dental assistant may polish the natural and restored surfaces of the teeth under general supervision if the assistant has passed an exam approved by the board. So I think where the committee wants to go is if you want to expand that, it most likely would need to be done in the statute if you're trying to broaden the range of what they can do with the appropriate education.
That's a great insight, Mary. Dr. Brady, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to just briefly describe how they do it in Mississippi, because it does take a lot of work, like that has been identified. But what they've done is the anesthesia advisory panel there will generate minimums to whatever course that is. Like, you know, someone can't come in and get an IV moderate sedation permit if they've taken the course that is not a board-approved course in the state of Mississippi. So they have to be board-approved courses or else they won't get their IV moderate sedation course. And so the anesthesia advisory panel said, okay, these are the set minimums that we want to see from this course. And then we interview these courses and we actually have them fill out an application. And then we give a recommendation to the board. And then the board either puts them yes or no on their list. It seems like we don't have that instrument in place, or maybe we do, what Mary has identified, that the board can even do something like that. But it does take some work, but there are some ways that I think even within our advisory panel to create criteria for what we're looking for that assistant to say, okay, this is what we want to look for in a course, to have the board, you know, put their approval behind it so that people know where to go with this. And I think what really this comes down to, maybe not so much in this first section, but it comes down to when we're talking about the next one, the operating dentist is the 1301 permit holder, where we're going to actually like look at that and what are those critical events and how can we make sure that we have that team approach to dealing with that type of environment. So I would still like to see this in here if there's a way or an avenue, but if Arizona just does not have that at this point, then we should have that discussion too.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. Jessica?
Thank you. So the board does have some regulation over dental assistants. They have rules about how dental assistants apply for radiography certification by credential. So I don't know if that's helpful for your purposes in terms of maybe, say, referring back to those rules, or if there are some way that you could refer back to the radiography certification or something of that nature, because it does require them to have a certification by another state, territory, that basically allows them to do this in other states, and that's how they get the certification and ability to do it here in Arizona. So to the extent that any of that is helpful for what you're trying to get to, I just wanted to point that out.
That's great. Susie, do you think we have an avenue to create something like this? We have a list of boards, you know, approved anesthesia assisting courses, or?
We don't have anything like that because we've never needed anything like that as far as assisting goes, because we don't regulate the assistants.
Okay.
Jessica, this is Sherry. You referring to the credentialing of the radiology by assistants in other states to Arizona?
Correct. It's Rule 204 and 205.
Sorry, I had you on mute. I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay, yes, it's 204 and 205.
Right, and that would be for the radiology if they met the what was the requirements. And as far as for radiology, you had to have completed a written examination, but there's nothing in there. As far as this, it would have to be expanded, which would be, I mean, we would all have to talk about. But I guess, Lizzie, what do you think, Mary?
Well, I think you're right, Sherry, because that the credentialing for the radiography goes to the statute I just pointed out before.
Right. Yes.
So if you want to have some kind of credentialing process, I believe 32.1291 would be amended.
Right.
Add the requirement, and then you expand that to credentialing from another state.
Those are some great insights. Dr. Snell?
Yeah, I love what Sherry said as we go down this path. We don't have this in place because we haven't needed it. As we look, we went through and did all the audit of those occurrences where people had issues. And I mean, you guys know I bring system, I have a system with me. I think it's smart to do, but from adding it as a statute and regulation, what that requires, we haven't needed it and things have been safe. I don't see the real need to change something that's not broken.
Thank you, Dr. Snell. Dr. Lau?
Yeah, I know that we have credentialing for coronal polishing. We have credentialing for radiology. We have expanded functions now. What is the feasibility of maybe having something like that for oral maxillofacial assistants, having anesthesia, monitoring capabilities, and the courses that they list there? Would that be a challenge for the board? I mean, we seem to have had the other ones. This could be, you know, something that we could put in there to answer some of these questions in the sedation and anesthesia documents.
Yes, Dr. Lau, we do have those. You know, they're not necessarily board approved, but they are approved by our national society. Dr. Blazek, you want to add anything to that?
Well, I was in have kind of a two-part addition. One, I think we could probably table this discussion about anesthesia assistance for the time being and get through more of the document. And I guess my second part was to Miss Mary, is there harm, if not today, of course, but is there harm or would it be appropriate for us to add something to our current statute? And then when this goes to the board for approval, when board realizes, hey, we don't have this this jurisdiction in place yet, can we create an anesthesia panel or what have you? And then we start from there, you know, just because I don't want us to keep just, you know, belaboring the same point when we have some opportunity, we're all on the phone and on the computer to run through some more documents.
Right. So if I understand your question, are you suggesting to recommend that the board seek a statutory amendment?
Yes, to where we could have this written in our current statutes.
Well, as you're probably aware, I mean, the board can always choose to seek a statutory change. They can't do it. You know, there's only certain times they can do that, and it's a policy decision that's up to them. I mean, this committee can't bring about any legislative changes. So I don't see anything wrong with the board, with the committee recommending that the board do that, but you can't put the cart before the horse and put it in your rule before they have the statutory authority, because it probably wouldn't get through GERC, but I would defer to Jessica on that. But you have to have authority to do a rule, so you can't kind of bootstrap it and bring the statutory authority in after the rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah, I mean, this may be something that we need to look to in a little bit more detail at another time. Allie?
Yeah, thank you. I guess a couple clarifying questions on it to see if it could help it not be tabled and be able to keep on moving on. So one question I would have is, would there be any issue of just leaving it at PALS, one person PALS and one person BLS, and not even having this option of a board approved assistant course, right? So that's one question I have about it. The other question I would have is, you know, how many assistant courses are there like dance? Could we just reference those specifically and take it off of the board's plate as it being something that they would do and instead reference one of those organizations instead? So just wondering if either one of those things would be acceptable without creating, you know, kind of a chain reaction of a lot more work by the board to have these approved courses.
Good point. Jessica?
Yes, thank you. So, yeah, I completely agree with what Mary said about not being able to put something like this in the rules until you have the statutory authority to do so. However, I do want to point out, because it seems like what we're talking about is having that additional person in the room with the pediatric patient. And 701 talks about the procedures and functions performed by a dental assistant under supervision. A11 talks about observing a patient during nitrous oxide and oxygen analgesia as instructed by the dentist. So it looks like your rules already provide for a dental assistant to observe the patient so long as it's under the direct supervision of the dentist.
Great point. Great point. And I think to Dr. Snell's point, I mean, absolutely, you know, the adverse occurrences and the things that we've seen have been very safe. I think this is just one more opportunity for an assistant that may not be able to do a PALS or an ACLS, but can get through a dance certification program. I think it allows one more opportunity for somebody like that to take on.
One follow-up. This is Mary. To Jessica's point, and I don't know the answer to this. I obviously know what nitrous is. Oxygen analgesia, 1301 is talking about general sedation, right? I mean, would that,
correct.
Would 1301 go beyond what?
Yes.
Analgesia is?
It's another level of anesthesia. Yes, it's a deeper level.
Yes, I'm not quite sure it would fall under that. It looks like that's a different.
No, definitely something to have to be expanded there. That's for
yeah,
sure.
I think somewhere there, it would need, something's going to have to be changed. Well, and maybe it's that rule. Maybe you could expand 701A11.
I think we have some good input from everybody. We feel comfortable maybe putting that on as an agenda item at the next meeting or so, that we can actually talk about what that may look like. And maybe Susie and Jessica may be able to come back with some other answers too from the board's perspective.
So I can add that rule language 701 to this rulemaking packet that we're working on. And that'll give you an opportunity to look at, you know, whether changes in 701 would make these changes to the pediatric endorsement rules clearer.
That would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
In the meantime, do we want to remove this accreditation from a board-approved assistant course?
Dr. Brady?
I think maybe it's going to depend on what that meeting, like what we discover out of that meeting. So maybe what we could do is just like highlight it and circle back to it or add it back into the comments on how we're going to approach that. And then for this one.
Thank you. Oh, sorry, Dr. Brady.
Oh, no, that's okay. And I think you know, and for all intents and purposes for what we're talking about here, B can just end at basic life support. Because all the other ones are just higher levels of education that requires BLS anyway. So it's redundant after that point.
Thank you. Dr. Blazek?
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, just, you know, put it on the back burner, highlight it, make it so we can readdress it. That was all. Should I take my hand down? Sorry.
And our... Since we're going to be using the acronyms for PALS or ACLS, do we also want to use and define an acronym for BLS?
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Snell?
I'm just wondering, in an attempt to just finish it up, I think AMIS does a pretty good job of regulating what courses for assistance are value and which ones aren't. So rather than saying a board-approved assistant course, could you say an assistant course that is recognized by AMIS or by something else that we have confidence in as a dental board, as a regulatory type of entity that would allow that to move forward from a language standpoint?
I like that. Dr. Brady?
I'm not trying to be the slow boat here, but I actually really think that we should have an agenda item just for this discussion completely. And the reason I say that is I know that AMIS and ASDA are actually meeting and are having a pretty good meeting right now about Model Edge that talks about this in particular and has a lot of the particulars and the details about this. And I'm hoping that they have some resolution. And I think that's forthcoming. So if we have this as an agenda item, I think we're going to be able to understand this a little bit better at that point.
Let's table it for an agenda item at the next meeting, and we can keep moving forward here. Jessica, would that be appropriate? We can just highlight that, and we'll leave it as is for the time being. But we come back as an agenda item to define what a board-approved assistant course would look like.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, so that brings us down to number two. If the operating dentist is the Section 1301 permit holder, there is a qualified auxiliary staff present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient during the procedure. The auxiliary must have current certification in a board-approved training program for such a role and have current certification in PALS.
So I think that if this is where, again, we talked about they don't have to be PALS certified because we're not talking about the pediatric designation here, right? This is just a general 1301 permit holder. Am I correct in saying that?
I think that's it. I think in the verbiage it should be 1301P permit holder.
Yeah, I can't see, but I think we are still within the pediatric designation section, or are we not?
I think what Randy's talking about is that first line and two. It says section 1301 permit holder.
Correct. So this is under subsection Q, which is talking about the permit holder.
Okay,
who has
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Go ahead, Ollie.
Isn't that Q redundant? Or is this point in here about the discharge? Right? So to me, that paragraph two seems redundant about who's there because we cover that in the previous section. But it is important for the discharge aspect of it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. It's redundant. I thought it's staying the same thing.
I would agree. Seems like we could strike that.
Right. I think 2B makes sense. Right?
Yeah.
I want to make sure that.
I like 2B. But I don't know if that would be C then or if it's a subset, however you would, I think we've all agreed whether it's a pediatric patient or an adult patient, then the provider must be present until the patient is able to be discharged, basically.
It is saying it must recover the patient, so I might be a little bit of, we might need to rework that wording. There must be a supervised or direct or indirect supervision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was referring to the individual monitoring the patient both intraoperatively and I don't know if it said postoperatively or not, but maybe we can clarify those roles in Q1 under, I don't know how we could do it, but it's going to be one of those individuals, I would assume, right? Probably the one who has PALS. Actually monitoring.
Right. Yeah, I think we're saying until the patient's responsive and follows commands and those types of things, maybe they're not wheeling themselves out the door at that point. But at that point, when the patient's awake and responsive to commands and what have you, and probably shortly going to be discharged, then it's okay for the individual with the P designation to, you know, leave the patient with a responsible individual in the office, I think is what we thought, or what my understanding would be.
Yeah, the way I was reading it before was that the person with the PALS designation could stay with the patient until they were ready for discharge and use the scoring system. Are we wanting to say that the permit holder must stay with the patient and cannot start another case? Or can they transfer a non-fully recovered patient to somebody with PALS?
Well, that's what we've been saying all along, is they can start another case if the patient's dischargeable or they're under the care in recovery, direct monitoring, and whoever we want to specify for the P designation, we can do that here and now. Dr. Brady?
So I think there's two things going on here, right? There's one, we're talking about going from direct to indirect supervision, but we're also talking about, and it's already raised, but it was the capturing of the procedural monitoring is when you have a 1301 permit holder doing both the carrying the general anesthesia permit, but also doing the dentistry that's involved, the surgical procedure that's involved. And so what was specified, is that you just have one person designated during that procedural monitoring role during those critical time periods. So that's why I think that was spliced into two separate things. And so I don't think we can just blitz that whole paragraph too. I don't think it's redundant in that nature.
This is Jessica. I'm slightly confused because we did say in one that they have to have these two following people there during the critical portion of the procedure. And then we go on to say that again, there is qualified auxiliary staff during the critical portion of the procedure, which seems to be the same thing.
Right. So I'll clarify that. So in one, if you have someone that's dedicated to just doing the anesthesia, like that's all that they're doing, they're a 1301 permit holder, they are monitoring that patient continuously. In option two, what they're saying is that, you know, it can't be the assistant that is actually doing the suctioning of the patient in the mouth, because then everyone's looking at the patient and no one's really monitoring the situation, right? So they could have one provider and two assistants and they're all occupied doing the surgical portion of the procedure. So what two is really specifying is that if 1301 permit holder is not just, if they're doing more than just the anesthesia itself, it has to have a designated person watching after what the monitors are telling them. Like it's a designated individual.
Mr. McGuy?
So Dr. Brady, are you saying that the first section mostly applies to a dentist anesthesiologist and that person would require an additional person with PALS and an additional person with BLS? But then two is applying to an oral surgeon, and that person would need two people with PALS and a person, so you need four people?
No, and you know, I know we're generalizing that way, just because, you know, there's oral surgeons that do just anesthesia, and there's dentist anesthesiologists that do oral surgery type of practice, so to speak.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, for how us to conceptualize it, it's two is just really talking about who is doing the charting, who is making sure the trends in the vital signs aren't starting to spy or go downwards, right? It's like, maybe they're at a normal vital sign and the alarms aren't sounding, but yet maybe they started with a trending pattern and they're recognizing those nuances in anesthesia, right? Maybe they're getting slightly bradycardic. Maybe they're at 98 and now they're at 62. Well, they're still normal, you know, heart rhythm, but there's a trend and a pattern that's happening. So what two is really focusing in on is if the provider is occupied doing the surgical portion, but also has the permit of doing general anesthesia, there's someone that's doing the procedural monitoring for that team practice. And I think that's what, you know, Amos is trying to get at as well with their dance qualified assistants. It just means that they can't have like, okay, I have my assistant that's PALS and my assistant that's BLS. But we're all in this room and all of us are working and no one, you know, working towards a surgery thing. They need to have someone that's just solely looking at the patient and the vitals and what's going on with that record keeping. I think that's the intent of two.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. Dr. Blazek.
Well, Dr. Brady, I like, the intent. You know, certainly that's the way, you know, most of us practice is that you've got, you know, you're the surgeon doing the procedure and the anesthesia. You've got a assistant suctioning the mouth and watching the oral cavity. You'll have someone passing typically, and then you have a dedicated individual in charge of airway, in charge of the monitors and things like that. Where I have a little bit of an issue with this scenario, even for the pediatric patient, as I read it now, is we're telling them that the assistant has to have a board approved training program and have a PAL certification. And I think in the scenario such as myself, who will have a 13-1 P designation, I'll carry the PALs. And my assistants could be either the board approved program or BLS minimum or ACLS. I would prefer to see it say, as opposed to having my assistant have PALS.
Thank you, Dr. Blazek. Mr. McGuy?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I keep asking these questions just to try and so that for me to understand, because my hope is that when other people go and want to understand these rules, that they're not having a, you know, call up those of us on the committee and say, what did you guys mean when this got written? So I guess, you know, so I keep asking these clarifying questions. So what you're saying, Jason, is basically like in that scenario, not necessarily having four individuals, just that the one of the two required people that is PALS is the one that's required solely responsible to be monitoring the patient. Do I have that right?
Sorry, I was muted. So yeah, that's kind of the crutch of this here is that when we were in our, we're talking about this, it's like, you know, if we're looking at an individual that Mike Blazek had identified that's either going to be watching the airway and watching the patient, but they're not really responsible for the suctioning and passing things off or, you know, running to grab something out of sterilization. And so, and to his point, if that person has that BLS or PALS or that board certified program, then so be it, right? You know, with criteria one, we're saying that there's going to be at least two people there that have PALS. So, you know, criteria two is kind of on that same vein, but we're also saying that we need to have, in addition to A and B, we need someone just responsible for watching after that patient, right? Maybe that's where this lives with the dance certification. Maybe this is where that lives with what we're talking about, with that board approved type of course.
So it wouldn't work.
And then the other section, and you know, it's two and two, but really two really applies to everyone with PEDS that, you know, if you're going from direct to indirect supervision, who's there with that child should probably meet that criteria regardless. And so those two are a little bit kind of intermixed, but I think two in this
really
situation.
Three.
Oh, yeah, it really should
be three.
Two
should be three in its own.
Right.
Right. I think that added some of the confusion. It was two, the one underneath was as 2B, which made it seem to relate to two, right? But what's this? I mean, so just to get a little more clarity. So in a scenario, you've got an oral surgeon, you have a BLS dental assistant, and you've got a PALS dental assistant. The BLS dental assistant is handing the instruments. The PALS dental assistant is at the head, supporting the airway, watching the monitor, right?
As it is written, but that's where I would request that it not be written that way, about the dental assistant needing PALS.
Right. I think essentially what it's saying is whoever that is the person watching over the airway. I mean, if this is in continuity of one and two, meaning two has to have everything that one has, it's just that person that's watching over that procedural monitoring of the patient. So whatever that is, whatever that criteria may be, you know, I'd like to hear from our OMS colleagues on that particular thing. Because they should be able to address that better than I can articulate, but I think that's the intent of that whole thing.
I think we should stay consistent because we offer ACLS PALS or board certified assistant course or AMIS, you know, approved assistant course. Probably should be read the same there at the very, very least. Dr. Blazek, what do you have?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I would just like to keep it consistent. And, you know, I think the reality of how things occur right now and to go back, you know, that we do really have a relatively safe operating system. And it is the model of having one person dedicated to the anesthesia monitoring in the airway. And I believe that person is a auxiliary staff who has at minimum BLS and currently we don't have any requirement for certification, but there is this move towards advanced training. So I would like us to leave it as you have it written, but I think to require the auxiliary staff to have PALS as well as the anesthesia provider or the anesthesia operator would be excessive. As an oral surgeon input is what I would put. And to be completely honest and maybe a little critical of Dance, because I know that system well, and I know Cal Amos well, because I've had assistants go through both, and I've conducted the Dance course, and I've reviewed the entire Cal Amos course. Frankly, they aren't really, because Ali and I talked about this briefly. The way those courses are constructed are really about airway and anesthesia monitoring and how to react in an emergency situation. They do not focus real heavily on pediatric population. So if I was critical of those courses, that is one of their areas that could be improved. And that's something that, you know, I personally have spoken to the president of AMIS right now is I just drew a blank on his name, but Eddie and I both know him.
Eddie Tyner.
Yeah. And, well, the incoming is, Egbert. We're out of Washington. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an area that they can improve on is to have a whole nother section of the Dance and the Cal AMIS course, that focuses on pediatric, anesthesia delivery. So, but I think what we currently do is so safe is because of how we divide the team up. And we do have someone who's, like you said, Dr. Brady, watching the monitor, watching for those trends. We understand the importance of maintaining the airway and using precordial stethoscopes. And I don't think that I'm speaking just like as a rarity or unicorn in anesthesia. I think most oral surgeons, that's how we provide the anesthesia. So I'll stop there.
I'd agree. Dr. German.
I think, you know, I don't disagree. I think the objective of this whole exercise really is to provide rules and regulations in which teams can operate together. And teams, I think, who operate the best are those who are trained equally. So, you know, in the OMS office, it'll be dance. If I go to a dental office, I'll bring an RN who has PALS training. And it might be different for other teams, anesthesia team models, but I think the point is that we allow them, and I think I like this either or, like Randy was saying, I think ACLS or PALS or board certified or board accredited training program, and let the chips fall. And I think the providers and the teams will actually be trained within what is comfortable to them and what allows them to operate. But what's important is that they know how to treat a child, in this case, in an emergency situation.
Thank you, Dr. German.
Jessica, and then Dr. Blazek.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is that during this procedure, there should be at least one person there whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient.
That's
period.
Correct.
Regardless of whether the permit holder is also the operating dentist or not.
That's right.
So I'm kind of thinking, just to get us closer to the desired language, I find this first part of number two confusing. If the Section 1301 permit holder is the operating dentist, it sounds to me it's irrelevant whether they're the operating dentist. There needs to be somebody there whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient during the procedure.
That's correct. Dr. Blazek, and then Allie, and then Brady.
Well, I was, my comment was more addressed to what Dr. German had said, and what I would add, and I know we can't write this in the statute, but again, to reiterate what so many of us have talked about already, it not only is it the level of training, but it is the constant repetitive aspect that occurs in the oral surgeon's office where we do this every single day, 5 to 15 times a day, sometimes on a Friday when it's really busy or whatever. And I think that's what Dr. Snell does. That's what you travel with these assistants that know your cart or whatever, you know. And when you don't do that, and you leave a patient with a dental assistant who has no experience, that is where adverse occurrences go south really quickly, and you don't really have any common ground to stand on. You ask for an instrument or a device, and the individual you're asking of has no clue because they've never been involved in that world. And yet, you know, in our offices and many of us where we go, it's every day we do the same thing day in and day out, and that's what breeds comfort and safety.
Thank you, Dr. Blazek. Mr. Begay?
Jessica, I think that's a really good question, what you had about, you know, that first sentence being confusing. But basically, if I'm reading it right and understand what the intent may be, is that in that, in the part A, part A1, that would mean that the person who is the Section 1301 permit holder is going to be a dentist anesthesiologist whose primary responsibility is monitoring the patient. So that's why there in two, if the Section 1301 permit holder, and this is in the case of an oral surgeon, is the one doing the procedure, then you would have the separate. So that's why it has that, you know, as I'm understanding this better, I think that's what it's getting at, is that, one, with needing those extra people applies to all of them, but then two is saying that if the permit holder is the operating practitioner, the oral surgeon, that's where you need to make sure you have somebody. Because in the other scenario, the 1301 permit holder would be primarily responsible for monitoring the patient.
So I agree, and I'm thinking that if that's what's going on, then maybe this shouldn't be a part of subsection Q. Maybe this needs to be pulled out into its own subsection that basically says, you know, if the 1301 permit holder with the pediatric endorsement is the one who is operating, then you have this additional requirement, regardless of what's happening with subsection Q.
That's an excellent point. That's why I had my hand raised kind of for that reason. But, you know, the way that I see it and, is, you know, the anesthesia provider is the 1301 permit holder. And, you know, while his eyes are occupied inside the oral cavity doesn't mean that he doesn't have the knowledge and the skill set and the ability to rescue a patient. He just needs another set of eyes to relay information and know what, how to relay that information and what information is germane to the situation. So they, it can't just be anyone off the street, right? It has to be somebody, but essentially what they're doing is they're using their senses. They're evaluating the airway the entire time. They just need someone that's just solely watching for that respiration rate going down, or they're getting, you know, their heart rate is going down or going up, and understanding enough to be able to alert the general anesthesia permit provider holder to take action or to dismiss it or to whatever they're going to do. It's, that's what really that is talking about. So you may be right. That really applies across the board, regardless if it's an adult or peds. But I think right where we're talking about this and how it was focused in on peds is that we're doing this endorsement for this age group that is a little bit more critical and actually has different requirements for training purposes. So, I mean, I'll kind of open that up for discussion, whether this should remain just as a ped section or if this should be kind of more of a global concept, which is what, how they already practice anyway. I mean, that's how they do this.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. Dr. Blazek?
I agree wholeheartedly, and I'd be fully in favor of making this its own subsection. You know, for a long time, the way the statutes were is it just said you had to have three other people there. We never really defined or said, you know, one has to be in charge of the airway, and I'm or the anesthesia, and I'm all in favor of that. However we get it in here, whether it's under PEDS or it's PEDS and it's under the global definition of 1301, I think it's a great idea. And I tell you, I think from our constituents, it would be fully in support of that.
This is Jessica. So I pulled out into its own subsection and added some language that makes it more consistent with the previous subsection. But I think what I heard now was that you don't necessarily want to limit it just to the 1301 permit holder with a pediatric endorsement. You want it to apply to all 1301 permit holders.
Yeah, so can you write a permit holder who does or does not have a pediatric endorsement? And is that sufficient, or is that not a good way to write it?
Well, there's a little more that would change, right? So if it's not just pediatric, it's not PALS, and then do we want to say it's ACLS? So I think there'd be a little bit more conversation to it, right? But I think having it, I think that's a great point that you brought up, Jessica, having it be in its own subsection.
Thank you, Marty.
Just by nature, they're already going to have either PALS or ACLS depending on the patient population they're working with. But I think the big thing to say is, sorry, my hand is still raised. The big thing that really to just kind of to say there is it's the 1301 permit holder who is participating in other dental procedures besides just the anesthesia or sedation, or I guess just the general anesthesia, because we're talking about 1301 permit. It's really how we're identifying this subsection. And then I guess I would leave it to Randy and L Snowflake. That's your name on there. It just, you know, what you envision that to say.
Yeah, that's a good point, too, of, you know, if there is a dentist anesthesiologist 1301 permit holder there, you don't need a second person watching your monitor.
No, well, yes, absolutely. And, Randy, we have some language in that Amos has put forward on our anesthesia monitoring assistance or and things like that we could probably draw from.
Right.
Open this situation.
Yeah. And the only thing I would say, you know, Ali, is it is true most of this is oral surgeons, but, you know, the dental anesthesiologists, they are just as qualified or allowed to do what we do, frankly. So it does apply to both levels, but I do think the majority, like 99% of it, is going to be us. Dr. Brownstein, he's a pediatric dentist and he does DA, dental anesthesia. So he could technically, you know, work on a pediatric patient on his own. I'm all for looking at the language in the Amos book and coming back, or promoting some other rewrite of this if you guys would like. I'm also for just really being blatant and saying, you know, spelling it out that you have one individual, that is monitoring the anesthesia and the airway at all times during the, or at critical portions of the procedure.
I think most offices have that in oral surgery offices. You'll see that we actually write it in the op note, who was the anesthesia assistant.
Correct.
It's actually designated.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
This may actually come in that agenda item that we talk about too. So I think we'll get some more clarification when we have that meeting.
For sure. Yep.
So do we want to add maybe an anesthesia monitoring assistant paragraph or have it as its own and one that's specific to pediatrics and the other one is a more global, a global approach as well?
Yeah, I think that's directionally correct.
I thought I had my anesthesia evaluation guide here in the office that I was going to reference, but I don't have it.
How's that looking, Jessica?
Okay, give me 1 second. Okay, so what I've got so far is if the Section 1301 permit holder who administers general anesthesia, deep sedation, or any lower level of sedation to a patient is the operating dentist, the Section 1301 permit holder shall ensure there is an auxiliary staff present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient during the procedure and has a current certification in PALS if the patient is pediatric or has current certification in ACLS.
Nice job putting toss around of thoughts into clear words. Very well done.
That sounded great.
The only concern I had is...
I know Dr. German has to leave. Did he already take off? He might have already left. Dr. German had to leave. He has a case to do.
The only concern I had was where we say deep sedation or any lower level. You know, if someone is just an oral conscious sedation, I don't think you necessarily have to have one individual monitor the airway. Am I right, guys?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Randy. Then we would end up having to switch some of the other permits, the moderate sedation permits as well, to resemble that as well.
Okay, so we can get rid of or any lower level of sedation. Really, we're only talking about general anesthesia or deep sedation. I did remove the term qualified auxiliary because I am making the assumption, perhaps erroneously, that the way auxiliary staff would be considered qualified in this case was if they had the PALS or the ACLS. And then my second question was this original language about the auxiliary staff must have current certification in a board-approved training program for such role and the certification. Do you still want that language about the current certification in board-approved training program?
My thoughts, that's what we're going to discuss in this other topic probably. So leave it out for now or highlight it and we can come back to it just like the one above.
Yeah, I think we should leave it in there and highlight it and come back to kind of just trigger us to address that. Dr. Snell?
Thank you. I just saw that Jessica deleted it from R, but should she delete the same thing from Q, the lower level of sedation?
That's a good point. Do you see that in Q, Jessica?
I do. Do you want me to remove it?
I don't participate in any cases where there's less than deep sedation for the most part, so I'm just curious. I don't actually know what you guys do for that. So.
Yeah, what maybe Dr. Lout, Dr. Brownstein, Dr. Brady?
It's routine for us to do moderate, you know, oral conscious, moderate sedation, providing both the sedative and the delivery of the restorative care at the same time. That's basically how we're trained to do it. You know, it's a much lighter form of sedation where, you know, monitoring throughout the case isn't as vital as, you know, deep sedation or general anesthesia, since there's you know, few cardiac changes, few respiratory changes.
So no need for someone with PALS and BLS while doing the oral sedation.
No, I think that we should. You mean an additional person with PALS?
Yeah, yeah. So what this is saying now is that you would have the dentist with the permit and a person with PALS and a person with BLS at a minimum to even do something like oral sedation.
Well, but I think the highlight is general anesthesia, deep sedation in these paragraphs. I don't think it talks about moderate sedation.
Yeah, I mean, the intent here is 1301. It's a 1301 permit holder that we're talking
right,
about.
Right,
so you're
right.
Saying that, yeah, I mean, lower levels of sedation, I mean, it's still, like, it's going to apply to whatever we put into the other permit holders as far as the PALS endorsement, I mean, the PEDS endorsement.
So we'll take out that low-level sedation. Thanks, Dr. Snell. In paragraph Q.
In S, do we want to add anything that PALS certified recovery staff is doing under indirect supervision by the 1301 permit holder, or add anything that permit holder needs to become available, or, you know, something like that?
Direct or indirect? And are we going to add ACLS and a board certified or board approved assistant course? Dr.
Yeah.
Brady?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to rewrite that first sentence there.
So S really is a product of Q2, right? Because we're talking about the PEDS endorsement. We're specifying this.
It's R, which is different than R, right?
Correct.
So this is Jessica. I had a question about this because whose responsibility is this going to be? Is this going to be the Section 1301 permit holder who's just administering the anesthesia, or is this the operating dentist, regardless of whether they are
this
the
is
ultimately
this,
it's the
this is one in this. Yeah, it's everyone that's a 1301 permit holder.
But
I mean, it could rely to it could, you could say the same for adults and say ACLS and PALS and have it its own category, but.
Right.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is whose responsibility is it?
Yeah,
it's the permit holder.
It would go back to the permit holder.
Okay.
Right. Even if the permit holder, so if I read it, what it's saying is the permit holder doesn't need to be physically directly present while the PALS certified staff is recovering the patient, right? But
or ACLS or ANS certified.
Right. But if something goes awry, that 1301 permit holder is responsible for something that goes awry, and right?
or is immediately available to assist. Dr. Blazek?
Well, the only thing I was going to ask or add is I like how we have its own subsection, and really all we're talking about is discharge or recovery of the patient. So is it appropriate to start the sentence in such fashion that says, you know, post-procedure and during recovery, the 1301 permit holder shall ensure a ACLS certified or an assistant that has a board certification from a board certified program or a PALS certified assistant is with the patient until they meet criteria for discharge using a recognized discharge scoring system. We don't have to have PEDS or not PEDS in there. I'm wondering if we just say during the recovery and discharge, these are the criteria that have to be followed.
So it looks like a few sections up, there's already, in the version I have, if it hasn't been edited, it's M of this section that talks about discharging patients.
Right.
So maybe we should just put this into that.
Put that into that, I'm wondering, yeah.
We could. Dr. Snell? Dr. Snell, you had your hand up. You might still be muted.
Sorry, I should put my hand down. I was referencing the exact same thing that Ali was just saying. I think that S section, where it's specific to PALS, should be put under the Q section as a subsection if we want to designate the difference between one who has a pediatric endorsement and how they go about discharge. But the discharge instructions for general 1301 providers has already been established earlier in the document.
I would agree with that. It is written out, so this would be more specifically to a P designation 1301 permit holder.
Yeah, so basically under the subset of Q.
Yeah.
But in this case, it would still be the one who's administering the general anesthesia, not the operating dentist, unless the operating dentist is one and the same.
Correct. So we're talking about, regardless of how they did the procedure, is when they're going from direct and indirect supervision. So even though, you know, R is kind of a subset of the dentist being both the anesthesia and the operating dental thing, this is more of what happens after everything's done, right? Who can be there watching that over that patient? I know that we have language talking about they have to have vascular and pulmonary stability before you can go from direct indirect, and that's appropriate. But I think what we're saying here is for the PEDS endorsement, I think this is just a built-in mechanism saying that person has to have PALS, unless it could be the permit holder himself, but whoever they're utilizing until they have met that discharge criteria has to stay with that patient.
So I moved it up to a number 2 under Q. So in its entirety, it'll read, a Section 1301 permit holder who has obtained a pediatric endorsement according to subsection B and who administers general anesthesia or deep sedation to a pediatric patient shall ensure a PAL-certified staff monitors pediatric patient until the patient meets criteria for discharge using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system.
Right, we're going to broaden PALS or ACLS or a certified assistant course to that, to those anesthesia monitors. Thank you, Jessica. Dr. Snell, do you have any comment?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, is it, and this would be a question more for those that do pediatrics. So earlier in the document, it outlines in section L, the 1301 permit holder shall continuously supervise the patient So it's the permit holder that's continuously supervising the patient from the initiation of anesthesia or deep sedation until termination of the anesthesia or deep sedation procedure, and oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable. So do we have to then define specifically for the pediatric designation that there's somewhat specific from the oxygenation, ventilation, stable until discharge? Is that what we're trying to define, is that those minutes of time? I just wonder if what's already been written is sufficient, that, and we haven't specifically specified when we're done, when oxygenation, ventilation, circulation are stable. We haven't specified earlier in the document who we're releasing those individuals to. Do we need to, I don't think we need to do that because they're stable, but are you suggesting that under the pediatric endorsement because of the patients that are being seen there being under the age of eight, that needs to be more fully explained?
Dr. Blazek?
Yeah, I don't think we do need to. And what I kind of like what we did with the up and M under discharge criteria, we didn't tell people what discharge criteria system they should use. We just said you need to have an established discharge criteria system. And I think by keeping it, I won't say vague, but open to interpretation about how they're going to do it, you know, whether it's Aldretti modified score or it's the pediatric post-discharge scoring system, that's up to the provider. But they must have something in their documents that indicate what criteria that they allow discharge, and it certainly includes all those things you mentioned, Dr. Snell. But I like keeping it with less verbiage on the board and the statute part and allowing just the simple statement. So I don't think we need to repeat it, is my point.
Thank you, Jessica.
So I have in here staff who has a current certification in PALS or ACLS or who has accreditation from a board-approved assistant course monitors a pediatric patient until the patient meets criteria for discharge using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system, whichever scoring system they would like to establish. I guess my question is, because it's a pediatric patient, are we okay with them having someone who's watching the pediatric patient until discharge who does not have PALS? That's what this would allow.
I would think it would just be the PALS or the whole accreditation board approved is going to wait till we talk that through, but I would think it would be PALS at this time, PALS or the board approved course, not the ACLS, is what I would think.
So I think the ACLS is AN. I would think it stays in.
I would too. It probably is just another advanced training.
It's saying or, so we would say that someone who's trained in adults is okay to recover a pediatric patient?
Yeah, I think that is. I think that is what we're saying, because I think that's what's in practice currently. And, we've shown it to be effective and safe. And certainly you still have the permit holder there who is going to be PALS certified, and the patient's recovered to a point that, probably the need for some type of intervention is minimized. And in particular, if all the other criteria are followed, which means the patient is maintained on a pulse oximetry, that the alarms are not muted, and that the patient is maintained on oxygen, all those other criteria until ready for discharge, then I think you're providing safe recovery parameters. If we look at the adverse occurrences that we've reviewed, we know that the only one that there was a problem was, number one, the patient wasn't on a pulse ox. Number two, they didn't have any oxygen. And number three, they had a person who did not have They had BLS. That's all they had.
No way to see it. Turn the monitor off as well.
Correct. Yeah.
That's not what you do when it starts beeping. Just quiet it down. Turn it right off. Just kidding. Don't put that in the notes.
For clarification, who was that? No.
Well, Jeff, so we're going to circle us back to.
So on Q2, section 2, you have staff whose current certification in PALS or ACLS. Should we say, or who has accreditation from a board-approved assistant course?
Correct.
How that reads is you have staff that has PALS or ACLS. Yeah, there you go. I think that reads better.
Yeah, good catch, Dr. Lau. Very good, yep. Mm-hmm.
And I took the liberty of changing recover to monitors, but if that's not the appropriate word choice here, then let me know.
You say monitors will be the patient in recovery.
Could you move your toolbar again? Sorry. Yeah. There.
Or monitor a recovering pediatric patient. I don't know.
They're probably interchangeable. I mean,
I think you have a comma. You should put a comma after course. Staff who has a current certification in PALS, comma, or ACLS, comma, or who has accreditation from a board approved assistant course, comma, monitors a pediatric patient until the patient meets criteria for discharge using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system. Because otherwise it reads like the accreditation from a board-approved assistant course monitors, like,
There's like there's a grammar argument on both sides of that of using the commas in between. But
I agree. I'm old school. I think you're probably right. The more modern wear area, you don't
there's
need
a
it.
There's a name for it. I can't remember what it's called. Maybe Jessica knows.
The Oxford comma.
That's
or a serial comma.
There you go.
Wow, Jessica.
Why Jessica's here.
I thought she might know.
I love the Oxford comma, just as a personal aside. Okay, so we have staff who has a current certification in PALS, ACLS, or accreditation from a board-approved assistant course, monitors a pediatric patient until the patient meets criteria for discharge using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system. I heard suggestions of adding something about monitoring a recovering pediatric patient or monitoring a pediatric patient in recovery. Do we want to add the recovering language? Otherwise, it would seem that this subsection 2 could be slightly redundant to these other two people who have to be there during the procedure itself versus when they are done with the procedure and now recovering.
I guess that brings a good point. What does monitoring mean or what does recovering mean? You know, do they have a pulse ox on? Do they have EKG on? Do they have blood pressure? What are they monitoring? Are they just watching the patient?
I think it depends on what phase of monitoring or recovery they're in. So, Dr. Snell?
I was just wondering if we're making such a big deal about all of this for the pediatric endorsement, can we just copy the verbiage from section L and then add in, which talks about how the anesthesia provider should be staying continually supervising the patient until oxygenation, ventilation, circulation are stable. And then in recovery, a staff member can take over. Because this to me just comes out of nowhere. Like Jessica was saying, it almost reads like staff can monitor them and the dentist doesn't have to be there. The dental anesthesiologist doesn't have to be there. So if the point is we're trying to designate for the pediatric kiddos that during recovery and prior to discharge, but after the anesthesia provider may have left because their oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable, then we should probably spell that out so people are clear about what we're trying to put in there.
It's a good idea. So if it says, So just that last part, just the oxygenation, ventilation, circulation are stable. So, right, monitors a pediatric patient once oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable until they meet discharge criteria.
Right. Should we also, I like that, Dr. Snell and Mr. Begay. Do we want to change staff to maybe, I like anesthesia team member or something like that. Staff could mean many different things, but so we're talking about team models and things like that. Versus staff.
I always think staff is an infection, so I try not to use that word. Anyways,
I would agree. I like team member or something, or anesthesia team.
Jessica, so as you're typing this, it would be after. So they would be able to monitor them after their oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable until they meet discharge criteria. Because the permit holder has to be there until those three things are stable.
Okay, staff who has a current certification in PALS, ACLS, or accreditation from a board-approved assistant course monitors the patient after the patient's oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable until the patient meets criteria for discharge using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system.
I like everything but staff, I guess.
What do we refer to them at other parts of this?
I was looking back. I don't think staff is used. I couldn't really see anything as I flipped back through.
We've got auxiliary staff in R.
Would it be 1301 permit holders designee?
No.
No?
I don't know. I was thinking we should call it MRSA.
I think auxiliary staff would suffice.
Yeah, I like auxiliary.
Are we're just referring to them as persons in Q1?
Right.
I can use person.
I think person might be consistent and easier.
Yeah.
I might suggest doing the same thing with R and just ensuring there is a person present with the patient during the critical portion of this procedure whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient during the procedure and has the correct certification.
Yeah, that way it's consistent.
It makes sense.
Okay. We're still okay with monitoring, and we don't need to say anything about recovery now that we've got the ventilation and the circulation and oxygenation in there.
I like it as written.
Okay.
Me too. I like it.
All right. Let me check and see. So we're going to discuss that later. I will make the acronyms consistent and define them. That's something that the board is going to discuss later. Also later. Okay. That brings us to 1302, unless you have something else on 1301.
Well, just one other thought on section R there. With it coming after the section describing the P, would it flow better if it moved up a section so that we recognize that that's not only talking about the P designation? I mean, I guess it doesn't matter either.
I actually think that's smart, Ali. Just from a flowing standpoint, that P is its own section. You don't have to go to anything else, and it's done. Seems less confusing to me.
Yeah, and it makes the P section R, right? But
okay.
Thank you for bearing with us, Jessica, as we worked through that section. I think we were able to clean it up pretty good other than figuring out the board-approved assistant course piece. So it's good.
Right. I agree.
Okay. Well, if you guys...
We're at a pretty good... I mean, we can either jump in at 1302 or we want to... I know there's a couple of things we want to table till the next time. I mean, this is a decent place to just break right now and maybe discuss upcoming... meetings. I'm up for any suggestions.
I think so.
Dr. Schnell?
I'm probably not going to be the popular one here, but my vote's just to continue because the more we can fit in each time, the less time off of work I have to take each time. So I'm not going back to work, especially without traveling and not having to hit traffic and worrying about that. I think we go till 5, but that's just my opinion.
Dr. Brady?
I'm going to have to jump off here in about 10 to 15 minutes, me personally, so I'd like to wrap it up for today. But you guys are finding tenure. I just think we're getting into a whole nother section, a pretty big section in on itself.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Brady. Dr. Blazek?
What's our minimum requirement for a quorum?
Thanks.
So even if Dr. Brady dropped off, we could keep going.
I have a meeting starting in 5 minutes as well. So I'm going to jump off shortly here, unfortunately.
You bunch of quitters. 2 hours, that's all you can handle?
I'll be sitting at this desk until 7. But.
And I'm fine with stopping at that point. I don't disagree with Dr. Snell. Plus, I think 1302 is going to go quicker because we've done such a good job with 01. But at that point, we don't have a quorum, so not much we can do, I think.
Well, should we keep moving until Dr. Brady has to leave then? We got 15 minutes. Let's see what we can, that's 2 hours and 15 minutes. That's,
yeah.
Let's do it. Dr. Brady, you got to go and you okay with that, Dr. Snell?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
All right. So we're jumping into 1302, which is, well, it used to be, parenteral sedation, but that's possibly being changed to moderate sedation, I believe.
That's correct.
Okay. And then we also added via a parenteral route. So if that's accurate, then we can move on.
No.
Wouldn't it read better if it was moderate sedation via parenteral route? We've got parental in there twice.
Oh, no. The first one is coming out.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's redlined. There it is.
So There was a suggestion, I believe, when I was putting all of the various versions together. There was a suggestion for doing the 1302P permit. That's what I have over here in the comments, which is why it still reflects 8 years of age instead of seven. So I'm not sure if this comment is irrelevant at this point, and we're just going to mirror what's in 1302.
I think if the 1302P, we have it, is going to come later in the document.
So I'm going to leave that comment there for now, and I'll move it down when we need to get
it. Well, in this section, this is just a general, isn't this just a general kind of definition? I mean, it's okay to leave both of them in here, isn't there? Isn't it? In this first part, is that what you're asking? I'm sorry, I'm not understanding.
No. I think the comment that it's going to come later, just as it did in 1301, we actually didn't get down to the requirements of the pediatric permit holder until a little bit later.
Okay.
And then so the language here that's all of this huge comment that basically writes the whole pediatric portion for the 1302 okay. permit, I think will come in a couple of sections.
Yes, I agree. Okay.
However, Dr. Snell suggests replacing references to section 1302 permit with level 2 permit. I think we
not we can delete that. That's really old.
way back.
And then similarly, Dr. German suggested this parenthetical. My comment though is that we don't typically include parenthetical information, and so I just put it moderate sedation via a parenteral route, and we'll remove the parenthetical.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was trying to chime in, but I think we got to take out via parental route altogether. I mean, moderate sedation is moderate sedation. We're not really talking about route of admission. We're talking about moderate sedation.
Here's my question for you, Jason, in doing that. What's the intent then for 1303? Moderate sedation or minimal sedation?
To me, that's minimal sedation.
Then
you may say that minimal sedation is only limited to oral sedation or whatever we do to get when we get down to that point. And I think that may be very well appropriate. I think, but when you're talking about moderate sedation, you can put someone in moderate sedation with oral meds too. It's not just
that's what people are
IV route. Exactly, so I think really right you now. Should. I really think we should take out route of admission here at 1302. If we want to specify that 1303 is only talking about a certain route, then we would discuss it at the 1303 level.
Go ahead.
I'm kind of looking at it, and you know, at first read, I was like, "Yeah, this looks good," but it almost does put us back into that old definition, which is what we're trying to avoid, and also, I do think it creates more confusion if you take it out, because if someone starts doing oral moderate sedation, then it certainly changes their, I guess probably how they have to practice in their office, and especially when it comes to pediatric patients. So this is a good topic to discuss. I didn't think about it until now mentioning it, because you're right. We can do oral route for moderate sedation. That's a tough one.
I actually don't disagree at all, Jason. I had the same thoughts when I was going through and rewriting all this stuff. The only reason I kept it in was because currently, as it stands, 1303 providers do moderate sedation. And so I didn't want to limit their ability to do moderate sedation by making the 1302 a moderate sedation level and making all the 1303 providers that do moderate sedation via an oral route have to go get 1302 permits. If that's what we decide to do, then we can have that discussion, but that's why I kept it in there, but I agree with you. It goes back to now we're confusing route versus depth.
Thanks, Dr. Snell. Dr. Brady?
So, I mean, it, regardless of ever, however you get there, regardless, we have to build the safety nets once you're there. If you're a oral sedation, going to moderate or IV. So I think you take out
IV going route
and we focus on what is our safety nets that we're building when someone is in moderate sedation. So that's why I contend that you take out via parenteral route. And if that means that if people are doing moderate sedation has to amp up their educational requirements or whatever it is, then so be it. They're in a moderate sedation permit level, regardless of route of admission.
Dr. Blazek, thanks.
I would 100% agree and support that, because then all the rules and regulations and the potential bad outcomes is all based upon a level of sedation and has nothing to do with a route. And so therefore, I've always been confused with why we have a 1302 and a 1303 when the level of sedation for both of those, the intent of them could possibly be the same.
Yeah, I agree. I think we get rid of it, the parental route.
Yeah, I think at the very beginning of all this, I think Chanel and Brady and Blazek was pretty adamant about the level of sedation and getting rid of the route per se. I think that was one of the big things from the get-go. So this would kind of match up with that. It cleans things up too. I mean, I was reviewing this and it was a little confusing going to, you know, parenteral to, you know, oral. So enteral route.
Okay, it's been removed. So now
lots of the sections that you'd have to remove it. More
yes.
And put them all in, so this would be good to clean it up.
So now we have, before administering moderate sedation in a dental office or dental clinic, a dentist shall possess a section 1302 permit. Let me look and see how we worded the first section of 1301, because I think we'd want to be consistent if we can. Yeah, we changed it quite a bit. I would recommend mirroring how we changed it in 1301, mirroring that here in 1302. Which would mean essentially removing the reference to the 1302P out of subsection A. And we essentially create a new subsection under A that talks just about the pediatric endorsement.
Agree.
That's where we're headed. That's what this looks like with the P designation. So.
Okay. So if you want, it might be a better idea to hold off on any further discussion on 1302 until I can make those changes, so then you have something to look at.
I knew Brady would get his way.
Motion to adjourn. Signy die.
Well, with that, do we need to add anything? Susie, do we need to add anything for onto the agenda or make a motion to put those tabled items? The anesthesia assistant credentialing statutes and the anesthesia assistant paragraph that we wanted to add.
This is Mary. You don't need a motion. You can just direct staff to put that on.
Oh, okay. So we'll go ahead and direct board staff. Thanks, Christina and Mary. For those two table items that we discussed about the anesthesia assistant paragraph, anesthesia assistant monitoring paragraph, and then anesthesia assistant credentialing statute that may be, we may need to expand that 13-12-91. And I think there was one other one that we could add to. Susie, go ahead.
There is a new substantive policy statement too regarding the route versus the avenue.
Susie, you must have two phones on or something. No one can understand.
Oh, I'm sorry, I may be sitting too close, Sherry. Hold on.
Oh.
A little echoey.
I think you guys might have to mute your laptops since you're in a room with a speaker on.
Is that better? Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thanks, Susie.
So there's the new substantive policy. So there's the new substantive policy statement that addresses the issue of looking at the 1302 as being the level of sedation rather than the route as it applies to the renewal. And I don't know if you've all looked at that policy or not, or if that would in any way need to be incorporated or looked at regarding this level.
Thank you, Susie. Jessica?
So a substantive policy statement, and Mary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is typically intended to put the public on notice of how a board is interpreting its own statutes or rules. However, it does not carry the same effect and force of a rule. So if there's something in there that you are looking to enforce on a regulated community, I would suggest looking at putting it into these rules since you're opening them up for amendments anyway.
Agreed.
So it'd have to come through a rule change then. Is that what you're suggesting, Jessica?
Yes, assuming that you have the statutory authority to do whatever it is that the substantive policy statement is saying, yes, you should be able to put that into rule, and now would be a good time to do that.
Okay.
If you want staff to send that substantive policy statement over to me, I can see what it says and see if there's a good place to add it to these rules and include that in the next draft as well.
That'd be wonderful. Could we direct board staff to send that substantive policy statement to Jessica, and we'll review that for the next anesthesia meeting?
Yep, I'll get that done.
Any other action items, anything that we need to discuss for any future meeting agendas? I think we've directed staff to do that. I think you see a list of the next board meetings we're supposed to have. That's June 17th.
That'll be virtual also?
I think all of these are going to be virtual.
That's what I thought.
Moving forward, which is, it's worked out pretty nice today. I thought it's gone great, so. I want to thank Yasmin for hosting us today. Christina, thanks for being here. Sherry and Susie, Mary, Jessica, you're all awesome. Appreciate everybody being here, their time and efforts. I know this is a very slow process, if you will, but I think it's grinding very smoothly. And I think we're going to have a great product when we're done. I hope everybody just hangs in here with us and we're making some headway. So do we, any other comments before we make anybody have a motion to adjourn this meeting?
Thanks for the snacks.
Well, you bet.
I make a motion to end the meeting.
We have a second?
Second.
Thank you. We have a second by Dr. Brady. Dr. Mount made the initial motion. We'll go ahead and adjourn this meeting. Thank you so much, everybody.
Got a vote.
Yes, got a vote.
Have a great week. We'll see some of you Friday. Thanks.
I'm in favor.